This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. A major report into housing's found government assistance to help first home buyers enter the property market works against improving affordability. And it's found low-income earners are spending more on rent, demand for homelessness services is up, and home ownership rates are falling. The Productivity Commission's written it, saying those struggling to pay rent need more support and is challenging all levels of government to do more to ease housing pressures. Oliver Gordon reports.
In 2016, Amanda Bingham was homeless and pregnant.
I had a pretty rough time during that experience.
Since then, the single parent has secured a subsidised private rental. She's happy to have a roof over her head, but it's expensive.
Half of my fortnightly pay is on rent. It is pretty tight. And, you know, you never know when that's going to go up.
A new Productivity Commission report has shown more people are finding themselves in Amanda's situation, pushed to the brink by rising rents with no prospect of making the jump into home ownership. Productivity Commissioner Malcolm Roberts is one of the report's authors.
So about one in four people receiving Commonwealth rent assistance are still paying more than half of their income on rent. Rents have increased sharply in the last 12 months or so. They're probably up about 9.5% from where they were a year ago.
And if rents keep rising, soon the government will have to increase the subsidy it provides to low-income earners.
About 79% of people receiving Commonwealth rent assistance are receiving the maximum payment. So if rents continue to increase more rapidly than inflation, they'll have to find ways to pay that increase in rents because the Commonwealth rent assistance won't keep pace.
Malcolm Roberts thinks governments need to redirect some of the money being spent supporting first home buyers to homelessness and social housing initiatives.
We are spending close to $3 billion a year to support people into home ownership at a time when there are pressing demands elsewhere. We spend $1.2 billion on homelessness services, but those services are really struggling. The demand on those services is continuing to rise, and there are a lot of people seeking help who cannot be supported. So when we look at the market as a whole and think about where governments should be investing their funds, we feel that there is better social returns from supporting people who are in greater need.
Federal Housing Minister Julie Collins says the Albanese government is committed to building more social and affordable homes, but raising rent assistance is not on the agenda.
We know we've got a lot of work to do. We know there's serious challenges, but we want to get moving on it as quickly as we can get moving on it. And we need to make sure as we do that, that we build the evidence base about what's working and what's not working.
But you're not thinking about raising Commonwealth rent assistance?
Our focus is on delivering our election commitment.
For Amanda Bingham, the realities of Australia's expensive housing market are starting to settle in. She desperately wants to own her own home, but that dream is starting to fade.
I think my mindset is kind of needs to adapt to the renting forever. Even though it's sad for me to say that to myself and to you, yeah, it's just so hard. It's so hard.
Melbourne woman Amanda Bingham ending Oliver Gordon's report. Australians sent to work in Antarctica have raised distressing allegations of widespread and predatory sexual harassment on remote research stations. Their complaints are detailed in an external review of culture in Antarctica. The Federal Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek's read it, saying the report's revelations are gobsmacking and extremely concerning. Many women who report unwelcome requests for sex and taunts from men in the world's most isolated place can't leave and have to continue working alongside the person they complained about. Henry Bellow has this exclusive report.
Meredith Nash has spent months listening to women posted to Antarctic stations, and she's disturbed by what she's been told.
They particularly described experiences of unwanted sexual attention, so sexist jokes, for example, or invitations for sex.
The Associate Dean at the Australian National University was hired by the Australian Antarctic Program to examine cultural problems and to make recommendations. The de-identified summary of her report includes instances of homophobia, taunting, offensive pornography, and gender-based insults. It also reveals a basic lack of knowledge about personal hygiene in an historically male-dominated workforce.
They aren't provided with appropriate menstrual products, or even just that their field gear is not made to accommodate women's bodily needs when it comes to toileting or trying to, you know, change a menstrual product.
The report reveals women felt compelled to hide their periods while on field missions, fearing men may judge them as incompetent or weak. When women run out of sanitary products, they have to ask what's been described as a gatekeeper, who is often a man, for more. In some cases, women feel forced to improvise or keep products inside their body for longer than recommended because no facilities are available.
I think on some level it's unethical for us to continue to try and encourage women to enter male-dominated fields if we're not confident ourselves that our organisations can keep them safe.
The report's findings are not disputed by the Australian Antarctic Division or the Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, who says this must spark change.
I was actually gobsmacked to read some of the reports here talking about, you know, pornographic images up on walls. I really did think we had eradicated this sort of thing from Australian workplaces decades ago. It's not acceptable.
Some women described the sexual harassment as predatory and widespread, permeating the stations.
I found that extremely concerning, and I've been very clear with the department that we need to make sure that every person working either at head office or in Antarctica feels safe. If they have a complaint to make, they can make that complaint without any fear of victimisation.
The director of the Australian Antarctic Division, Kim Ellis, says all 42 recommendations will be accepted and some have already been implemented, including restrictions on alcohol.
I'm deeply disappointed, and I have to say there's a level of, you know, embarrassment and discomfort.
Mr. Ellis says field manuals and training guides have been updated and warns cultural problems may be worse than the report reveals, acknowledging some expeditioners may be hesitant to speak up.
You have to have the cracks to let the light in, and I think this lets the light in and gives us the real authority to actually make change in the organisation.
That's Kim Ellis, the director of the Australian Antarctic Division, ending Henry Bellows' report. From teaching to nursing, there are thousands of workers wanted across Australia. One of the barriers to filling these jobs is the lengthy unpaid work experience placements that are required as part of university courses. For many single parents, it's a deal breaker, but advocates say if it's fixed, it could help women in particular return to the workforce. National education and parenting reporter Gabriella Marchant has the story.
Look at this one.
Oopsie daisy.
8 years ago, Wodonga mum of three, Tess Matthews, was just months away from qualifying as a teacher. But then her marriage broke down and she had to care for her kids full time. It meant that she couldn't do the weeks of unpaid work experience in schools that would have allowed her to finish her degree.
Placements are 4 weeks, 9 to 5. And there is no leaving early to pick anyone up, and it's completely unpaid. You can't get any assistance to do that. It's such a short time.
Tess Matthews now works as a teacher's assistant and estimates she's missed out on more than $200,000 in income.
I think about, in an income sense, how I would have been moving up in the experience level, and I probably would have been a highly experienced and valued educator that we desperately need.
And she's also been left with about $25,000 in higher education debt.
It dawned on me the sheer amount that my hex debt had, and I had nothing to show for it. So not only do I really not have a way to repay that hex debt, it's compounding and growing.
The National Council of Single Mothers says long, unpaid placements are stopping many single mums from gaining qualifications and earning high incomes. The chief executive is Therese Edwards.
They're in blocks, and so there is no consideration of women who already have a full-time job, sole parenting.
A Bachelor of Teaching mandates a minimum 4 months of unpaid practical experience. For nursing, it's 5 months, and for students doing social work, it's more than 6 months. A 2018 Grattan Institute analysis shows that parents are more likely to drop out of tertiary education and cite family and work responsibilities as their reasons for doing so. Therese Edwards is suggesting universities could be more flexible with the obligations they put on students to do practical placements.
You could have, you know, two or three single mothers doing a placement through sharing their hours. So it's not radical at all. It's quite sensible.
To help with the teacher shortage, Universities Australia is suggesting some sort of student income support, and the federal government's considering it.
Mum's trying to learn.
Wow.
To get smart.
Tess Matthews says without changes, everyone misses out.
So many women in particular in my course are going back and studying teaching at 45, 50. And that's only been because their children have left the nest. And I think that's such a shame.
It's Teachers Assistant Tess Matthews ending that report from Gabriella Marchant. The US President has told Pacific Island leaders that world security depends on their region. Joe Biden's addressed an historic summit in Washington aimed at countering China's influence. North America correspondent Jade McMillan joined me a short time ago.
Well, this is day two of an historic summit bringing a dozen Pacific Island leaders together in Washington for the first time. They have spent time at the State Department and will head over to the White House later today for a formal dinner with the US President Joe Biden. The administration has used this event to make a series of new announcements. It is promising to recognise the Cook Islands and Niue as sovereign states rather than as associated states of New Zealand. It's also named America's first envoy to the Pacific Islands Forum, and it's pledging more funding in areas like funding for the US Coast Guard in the Pacific and for the FBI to train local police officers. It's also released today a new Pacific strategy, and that spells out really what many would argue is the main reason behind the United States' renewed engagement with the Pacific Islands. That document warns that China risks undermining peace and prosperity in the region and, by extension, the United States through pressure and economic coercion. Joe Biden alluded to that when he sat down with Pacific Island leaders earlier.
Security in the Pacific and for the Pacific Islanders remains as critical as ever to us, and I hope to you as well, to secure the security of America, quite frankly, and the world depends on your security and the security of the Pacific Islands. And I really mean that. So this summit is also about deepening our enduring commitment to each other and our shared future.
And Jade, has the US managed to get a formal agreement through this summit?
Well, it has said again that it struck agreement on what it's calling a declaration of partnership between the United States and the Pacific Islands. We haven't seen the text of that yet, though, and it's unclear whether all of the leaders gathered here have signed on, given that Solomon Islands had signalled in the lead-up to this event that it wasn't prepared to do so. So exactly what that agreement covers and who has signed up to it, we hope to learn more about later today.
It's our North America correspondent Jade McMillan in Washington. The US president's also warning the hurricane, which hit Florida's west coast yesterday, could have caused substantial loss of life. At least 12 deaths have been confirmed so far, but emergency services are still assessing the destruction. There's been significant damage to homes and businesses. One of the hardest hit areas is around the city of Fort Myers in Lee County. Our correspondent Barbara Miller filed this report.
It's when you come to just one community, just one street, that you really get a true sense of the extent of the devastation caused by Hurricane Ian. Just on this one road in this community south of the centre of Fort Myers, there's mud all across the street. There's palm tree leaves that people are brushing away. There's a bolt essentially halfway up the road. It travelled down from a dock at the end of the road. The dock was ripped away and the boat sailed through the neighbourhood.
As the winds picked up, and it just brought the boat all the way here.
And you guys were watching this boat?
Right through our windows over here, yes. Literally just meandered here, and then as the water recessed, the boat just kind of sunk into the ground, and that's where it's been.
Now, as with any disaster, some homes seem to escape unscathed. Some are badly impacted. A couple of homes on this street were completely flooded.
We evac'd to East Lee, so came back today. My car, it has water in it. The whole house has water in it. We just checked our flood insurance. It's probably not going to cover all this, so it's just like, it's overwhelming.
Now, the boat which has sailed up this street and is now blocking the road essentially belongs to Kristen Hartman. who lives right at the end on the water. How long have you had that boat? Is it?
Oh, just since December.
But the real tragedy is that it's not the boat that Kirsten's worried about. It's her dad and her uncle, 78 and 80 years old. And they're on Sanibel Island, a barrier island. The causeway to that island has collapsed. And Kristen hasn't heard from her dad or her uncle since the storm began to move in.
At 11:30, they had said that they had water close to their knees. And so we said, you've got to get out, you know, go across the street. And they said, our neighbor's not home. We said, they'll understand, break a window, get inside. You have to get to higher ground. They have a couple of houses around there that are on stilts, and we try to get in one of them. So we don't know if they ever made it. So if someone knows where Larry and Bill Noon are, please contact the Hartmans on Rio Vista.
People here say they're managing to get hold of insurers if they have insurance. It's going to be a very long time before the financial and the human cost of this tragedy is fully known.
It's our correspondent Barbara Miller in Florida, and Hurricane Ian is moving off Florida and into the Atlantic before it's expected to make landfall again in South Carolina. What happened to Sydney fraudster Melissa Caddick has captivated many Australians, from the day she vanished to the millions she ripped off victims, including friends and family, through to her severed foot being washed up on a New South Wales beach. Police believe she took her own life. An inquest into her disappearance finishes hearings today. And our reporter Tim Swanston has been following the case.
So, Miss Caddick, we haven't open these envelopes other than to confirm there's cash in it, so we'll...
November 11, 2020 is the last verified sighting of Melissa Caddick. Her home in Sydney's east was raided by ASIC. The corporate watchdog had investigated her for the past few months. What they uncovered is an alleged Ponzi scheme where Ms Caddick took millions of dollars from investors and funds her lavish lifestyle.
Melissa, I'll just take you through valuables that were also found in the safe.
Ms Caddick is shown watching on as officers conduct the search and seizure, boxing up jewellery, cash, computers. Her husband, Anthony Coletti, tells the inquest he and Ms Caddick are emotionally drained. He says he didn't know about the alleged fraud. In his affidavit, he says the pair go to bed and he wakes to a noise the next morning.
Hey, Anthony.
Yes.
G'day, I'm Sergeant Riley. I'm the one who spoke to you on the phone.
Mr Coletti reports his wife missing 30 hours after that morning. The inquest hears police who come to his house felt uneasy about him and felt he was vague, evasive and gave inconsistent accounts. Anthony Coletti gave evidence across 3 days, delayed because concerns were raised as to his mental state. At the end of counsel assisting the coroner, Jason Downing's questions, he asked Mr Coletti if his conflicting accounts were given because he was lying about what actually happened to his wife. He also asked if Mr Coletti in any way delayed reporting his wife missing to give her time to go somewhere or to end her own life. Mr Coletti denied all of this. Ms Caddick's family have made a series of claims about the ASIC raid. Her mother holds ASIC responsible for the suspected death. Anthony Coletti, a DJ, wrote music about the raid.
You've got no rights.
We can torture you for 14 hours and then we can take whatever we want.
A forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Kerry Eagle, has given evidence Ms Caddick likely satisfied the criteria for a narcissistic personality disorder. She said there were no objective signs that Ms Caddick was not coping or that she was highly distressed during the ASIC search, but said she could have suffered a significant narcissistic injury.
This is an appeal for Melissa Caddick.
A number of issues are being examined by the coroner, including the adequacy of the police investigation and the appropriateness of the actions of AFP and ASIC officers during the search and seizure. The coroner's also being asked to make findings on things like manner, date, cause, place of Ms Caddick's probable death. It's already been flagged she may return an open finding.
Tim Swanston reporting, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's been a tough year for our economy, but spare a thought for the people of Britain, where the new government's mini-budget this week sent an already struggling economy into freefall. Today, business editor Ian Verinder on why our own budget next month will be one of the most conservative yet. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.